everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I am one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games, and I'm here, as always, with my good friend and co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for switching from you talking to me talking. It's very important that we switch things in this episode because we're going to be talking about switching things. But my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games as well, and maybe someday soon a card game, which is also a role-playing game. But we are here with returning guest Matt Orr from Wet Ink Games. Hello, Matthew.
Hello. I'm pleased to be back again. I didn't count them up, but I think this is my sixth time on the show. So I'm
sounds
I'm always happy to talk to you both.
Always happy to have you on as well, Matt. Even though you've been on here six times, who are you? I forget.
Oh, right. This could be somebody's first episode. So I am I'm Matthew Orr of Wet Ink Games. Matt is. You know, once you've met me once, you can call me Matt, but Matthew is Matthew Ward, my professional title. Wet Ink Games makes role-playing games. Again, unsurprisingly, I am a role-playing game maker with my business partner at Wet Ink Games. We also have made so far one board game, not a role-playing game. We've got more in the docket that we're working on, but that's a story for another episode, perhaps. But yeah, we make role-playing games, a lot of horror, a lot of horror and family-friendly. Those two things are the two kind of specialties that we've gotten because there's something for the adults and then something for them to play with their kids too. So,
I mean, in my experience, families that love horror, like the parents who love horror, often really are interested in their kids also finding hobbies, because people who like horror movies and they like the horror genre, you know, they find this to be fun. Sometimes they are slightly unusual people, and slightly unusual people want to make sure that everyone has their own unusual thing about them. Yeah. That's partially how I got into games too. My dad was a big like nerd, but we started off watching like Tales from the Crypt and like all this creepy stuff. I feel like those two things are related, in my opinion. Maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just my bias. Speaking of horror, this is also slightly off topic, but kind of on topic too. We'll get to our actual podcast topic. But this is a game that Wet Ink Games published. I played Home for the first time and had an absolute blast.
Love to hear it.
So I just wanted to also say that for the record on the podcast, for the internet to hear forever, that it was really fun and it made me afraid of my house last night.
Amazing.
I was a little creeped out.
Yeah, that one is our haunted house in a box, and you stack up the cards, you start outside the house, you enter the house, it's midnight, it's the witching hour, at the bottom is the morning cards. And you may or may not survive. And that's Doug Lewandowski, Yeon-Soo, Julian Kim designed that. That's basically our newest release. We're still on the promo train for Home, because it came out officially for the public at Origins. And so we'll still be heavily promoting it at Gen Con. So.
Highly recommend. But this is not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It was just on the top of my head.
I love it.
It was just on the top of my head. Today we're talking about, let me switch it over to Craig.
Oh, sure. To start with, we're talking GM topic. We're going to talk about switching to a new game, or just switching up things in general with your group. We can kind of expand into that. Might be switching GMs and staying in the same game. Might be switching from one game to another. When it's when does it feel like it's a good time to do that? What are good reasons to do that? How to know, like, if this is the right choice for the group? Because like sometimes it can be tough to leave behind something that's you've come to expect as part of your life, and try out a new game. As indie game developers, as small press publishers, we are constantly battling the monster of trying to get people who play some of the big, long-lasting, well-known you know, games and say, hey, why don't you try this weird little game that I have? Why don't you have your group switch and try this out at least for a little while? So let's dive deep into one of the toughest aspects, just from, you know, our own personal experience.
Absolutely.
Is having people switch games.
Like getting them on board with switching a game. Matt, you chose this topic. Why did you pick this one?
Well, because I have this, I didn't know how good I had it until I met a lot more people. But like my game group that I was in with Brandon, you know, co-owner of Wedding Games, with, you know, we'd go to his house on Monday nights, and we would play games for like a decade. Every Monday night for like a decade, we played this game. And like, it was just the way that we did it was like, look, I've got a little scenario. It's going to take, I don't know, between 8 and 12 sessions. And then we would play that game. And then the expectation was that like that GM got a break. And then the next person got to do a different game, telling a different story. And there was always a discussion about like, okay, who's going to do next? And there's always like 3 or 4 games. It's like, well, we could do, you know, that World War One thing, or we could do the Sky Pirates thing, or we could go back to the campaign that we left off 3 years ago and pick those characters up and keep doing the next adventure in the weird, you know, biotech versus the machines game that we were playing, you know. And it was just always, it was always like, and people would be like, oh, but we should try out this new game. And it was always like, well, if you want to try a new game, you run it then. Like, that was just, because like there's too many games and everybody has a bunch of pile of games and everybody wants to play a bunch of games. So it's just like, if you want to play something, you want to run something, put your name on the docket, you know, and like, what are you offering to run, you know? And I think basically everybody in that group has run a game over the years that it happened, you know.
Your group is a unicorn.
Well, yeah. I know, that's what I'm saying. Heard. That's what I started with. I didn't know how good I had it until I talked to other people that are like, oh yeah, I'm just so tired of being the forever GM. And I'm like, then tell your players they got to run a game. Like, this is change your table culture, right? I mean, that's my recommendation. But like, to get back to the real question, like, when is it time to change or whatever, you know, like if you need a break, like, or you've got being the GM takes a lot of planning. So like, you've got, you know, I've got 20 sessions, right? Or whatever. I mean, that's months and months of, you know, real life time that, you know, this 2 week adventure, right, of your heroes and or whatever. It took 8 months to play the, you know, because sometimes you miss a week or whatever. But then like, let that person set down that heavy burden, right? And then somebody else has been thinking about something else. And like, we would switch genres wildly, right? You know, we're like the sci-fi splicers game that we played, that's the robots versus the everything's alive, right? Your carapace armor is a living bug, and you fight the robots, right? This is a splicers game. But then somebody would do zombies right after, you know, and it's like, okay, great, new characters, we're all gonna die because it's a zombie game. And then when everyone's dead after 4 sessions, it's like, well, all right, what are we playing next week? You know, I mean, that's it was just led by the story itself. So that's the answer to the question, like, when is it time to change? It's like, well, when you've completed a unit of storytelling, then it's time to do something else, you know, and let that storyteller breathe, and then another storyteller can step forward, you know. But it's just natural to me that's how it works, because that's what I did for years.
When I hear about gaming groups that last a long time, it's either a gaming group like yours where everyone's kind of involved, whether or not you're playing the same system, but people are switching up campaigns at a regular time. They're switching off GM duties. Sometimes they play one shots or like the mini campaigns in between while the GM needs a break, because for that reason, being a GM is a huge emotional labor. It's an actual labor that you're also doing for the sake of your friends being a little entertained on a Friday night or whatever. It's fun for you, of course, but it is, I think everyone can agree, tougher work than being the players. The players it's not that they just need to show up and play, but they basically just need to show up and play. That's their minimum duty. There's a lot more planning involved to be a GM. So the GM gets a break. Everyone has a bit of stake in the game. your attention spans even are being a little tickled throughout. Like, you're not getting bored of playing one character. You get to try out new things. So that's one type of gaming group that I know that can endure for a very long time. Like, someone says, like, oh, I've been playing with this gaming group for 2 decades, 3 decades. It's either that, or weirdly, it's, oh yeah, we've been playing one campaign for a whole decade and I've had the same character since the beginning, blah blah blah. Personally, I would much rather be in the former group than the latter. Because it at some point the story's gotta be, you gotta end the story.
I've been in that kind of group too. And then, like, our characters got so powerful that he was like, the forever GM was like, well, I guess I'll buy this new, like, gods book and you can go fight some gods because you're super powerful now. And it's like, I'm like, or we could roll up new characters and start, I don't know, like, you know, whatever. It's a challenge to keep that story going is forever.
I guess, like, because I've been in some long campaigns that have lasted a couple of years, but they were in groups like the one, like yours, where, yeah, we might even be playing the same system, but we're going to mix it up here and there. And we're going to end the campaign when it's time to end the campaign, even if it's a long campaign. But I mean, I guess if people are entertained by the story of their decade long campaign, maybe the GM's like great at this long form storytelling. I wonder if it comes from like the tradition of fantasy books being like long series of multiple thousands of pages, many different characters, huge plots. Like, I just also wonder, like, how much story are you getting done in one session that you can make it last this long? I want to think about it positively. It must be a hell of a story, you know?
I think there might be a lot of other things that can work into that. Sometimes you've got groups who they just don't have a lot of other people around them who game. So this is the group and this is the game that we like. And so it's a little harder to infuse that sort of thing. And also, I've played in games where that lasted a long time and where the level progression or the advancement of your character was much more was slower. The expectation was, we're going to take our time getting to this next level up or getting to the character points that we're going to do. And you've got game sessions that are, you know, hardcore, I'm, you know, fists on the table, throwing dice constantly, doing the game, doing the rules. No Monty Python quotes from anybody. We're moving forward with the story. you can blow through and be like, okay, well, what's next? What's the next story? Like, eventually you run out of room to go. If there's advancement for characters, there's always an upper limit. Unless the GM is going to house rule other stuff even more powerful and bigger and whatnot. And plenty of people do that. But if you've got a group that's like, well, we're just a bunch of buddies who hang around and, you know, every 4-hour game session is really only 2 hours of gaming and we're taking our time and it takes 3 months to level our characters. And so that becomes a different kind of beast. But it's a fascinating thing to think about. I personally feel, because it speaks quite a bit to how varied the culture is within role-playing games and how, you know, we talk about, like, everybody likes their game a little different. Like this is just another way we're talking about how very different groups can be.
Yeah. I think I mean, this is sort of getting into something else, but it's related. It's came up to me when you said, you know, the getting your powerful, the levels up, we're going to take our time with all this. I think a lot of those stories that I hear from those decades long games, people aren't necessarily playing the same characters the entire time, but they're continuing the story world, right? So, like, you reach level, you know, you reach a high level, your character retires, you've got enough money to buy a castle, now you've received a title, you're, you know, like a king in Patagonia, let's say, then you pick a new character, right? Who's like either part of that person's retinue or like is a child of that person or whatever. And like the threats that your original character faced are still prevalent, but you're now playing the second generation or whatever of that story world. And like every once in a while, you might go visit your old characters and stuff like that. So like there's other ways to continue that that stuff. But that's not even what we're supposed to be talking about. But the no, thing I mean, that I think short circuits that thing is what we've done a couple times in my group is we played Microscope at the start of our campaign. And so then like we're like, all right, this world was cool. And, the history of the Lich King and how like the Lich lasted forever. It did like a God Emperor of Dune thing and collected all the magic together. So like magic is scarce now. And like we set all these tones and things for the world. And then like, okay, now we're going to play the steampunk dwarves are in the ascendancy and like everything is about keeping them back. And, you know, the turtles are on the island doing whatever, you know, like we set all that stuff. And like, it doesn't have anything to do with, you know, the big fantasy named places. We set all that stuff up. So then we get to enter the world and it has that kind of feel, even though we didn't play for a decade, we played like one session of Microscope. We have a world that now our characters are inhabiting and know the history of and stuff like that, because we did that in one session. So it's a way that keeps that renewal fresh, right? Like we thought there was going to be a big war there was a war in the southern continent. We set that there was a war ongoing between the orcs and the humans. And like, that was an important plot point or whatever. And then, you know, maybe it didn't pan out to be interesting. Let's move on. Let's make a new world where different things have happened. And, you know, I think that's another one of those triggers about when it's time to switch is like, is it interesting? Did we explore all that we had to explore from the tension of this situation? If it did, let's switch it, you know?
I mean, at that point, like you're switching new characters. You're kind of switching the angle there. That's the new campaign, just yeah. In the same system and same world. That's
we're not even the same world. Season. Make a new world.
Yeah. I mean, a spinoff is a new series. If you think about it, like a TV show, like, oh gosh, why is the first thing that came to mind? Big Bang Theory. You got Big Bang Theory. You got Young Sheldon. They're two different TV series in the same world with one of the same characters. I don't like what I've said out loud.
It is perfectly applicable because it is made by some of the same people. It has a shared backstory and everything to it, but the two shows are vastly different in their style, their subgenres of the comedy, of the comedy realm. So you could play a game where you're like, well, we're doing this thing, blah, 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 blah. And now we're going to, your switch up could be to a new game entirely, but it could also be to like a new genre within the game. Just using the easy example, if somebody's playing D&D, well, now we're playing Ravenloft, or now we're playing Planescape, or sure. The game, you're using the same system, but the game has a much different feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a completely different kind of story.
We did something very similar in my, the long campaign that I said, when I said we switched up campaigns, we actually did, it was in the same world and it was a continuation of the story, or at least one alternate version of what could have happened in the story. But they were also, I know my internet connection went out. I will still keep talking though, because my recording was fine. In the campaign, like it was different campaigns, it was different stories, even different like genres almost. Cause the first one we played was like 1920s, like, gumshoe kind of not gumshoe at that, it doesn't matter, like 1920s Cthulhu-esque horror. And then we did a 1950s where World War II spies, 1940s and 1950s were spies working for the British government, and then like continuing on from there. And then we did one that was in the what decade was it? The 60s, the 70s. We did another one when it was like a different genre again. In the same campaign, same world, same kind of basic ideas. And we could even have some callback characters, but they were different campaigns to me. And of course, in between, we'd switch GMs. We would bring in some other stuff. And I really liked that. It had the nice continuity that I think that people kind of crave, that, you know, you're spending a lot of time with these characters, you're spending a lot of time in the story, and even if you play 50, 60, 70, 200 hours of a game, that 200 hours that you're playing isn't 200 hours of story if you have a game with combat, for example. It's like if you were thinking about it like a book, the page count's going to be much less because a lot of that would be, you know, a lot of it's there for the mechanics. I mean, I think it still counts. Like, same thing with Star Wars. Episode 4, 5, 6, that's one campaign. 1, 2, 3, new campaign. 7, 8, 9, new campaign. How you feel about them? might change. And whether or not after that third trilogy, you get sick and tired of it and you don't even want all these little one-off spin-offs, you can switch to something new after that. That's how I'm feeling right now. I'm Star Wars'd out.
I think basically what you just said, but you said earlier, like the short campaign doing that, like we in the group that I was in, we believed in a palate cleanser campaign where it was like, okay, so somebody's doing the 6 month, 8 month, 1 year long campaign. Then we're done with that. We're definitely going to do something that somebody is, it's going to be a one shot. We're going to do Fiasco, or we're going to do like four different one shots in a row. And that's like the palate cleanser month to like, everybody's not, you don't have, nobody has to do any work because they're like one shots and they're just all, you open the box and you play them. Like if we played Fiasco or, you know, I don't know that we did a one page RPG, but that's that kind of thing where like you, when is it time to do it? It's like, it's time to do it when it's, this is the opportunity, right? We're taking a break. We pausing this game. Now it's time to do like you four people who all wanted to do something weird. Let's do those in a row, like boom, 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 boom. And then like that gives the next person who's picking up the mantle of the storyteller, you know, 6 weeks to get ready for the next thing. And, you know, and the other thing that gives you is like talking about when do you do it? It's like, well, when something new comes out, you know, like, oh, this has been reprinted or this is going to be on crowdfunding. So I'm going to be backing the new edition. I want you all to play the original version so you can see and get excited about it because there's a new one coming. You know, that's another opportunity to do that. Or the other way around where it's like, I finally got this. It's a game about this that isn't what you guys are usually into, but like, please try it because I think it's great. And, you know, again, like if you have that table culture of like, great, if you'll run it, we'll play anything, you know, like that is sure. We'll try all the weird games. Right. I mean, I made them play games that I don't know that they liked. That's what I'm saying.
That's fair. That's your prerogative.
I think you can, if you have a group that you think might be hesitant to kind of go and just, you know, try something else, you know, first is kind of getting, you know, talking to them and trying to build the trust and get them on board with the idea of something. And whether it's you as the GM now GMing this other game or whether somebody else is going to step up and GM some other game, you know, I would suggest like maybe this is the way to go is to not dive in with the plan of like, well, we're going to have this, you know, year and a half long campaign because you don't know for sure that the group's going to mm-hmm. really dig this mm-hmm. new game. So come in with like, if you're regardless of who the GM is, if you're going to be the GM for this new game, come in with something that really shows off the game, have it be a relatively short story. So it's done in, you know, maybe it's a one shot, maybe it's 3-4 sessions, you know, just long enough for people to kind of really get the feel for the game and get their, you know, get a chance to have a character advance or have some real plot development. But have there be an ending to this story that you're telling so that if the group is like, okay, well, that was a fun diversion for a while, but we'd rather go try this other thing or we'd rather go back to the old game or whatever, then you're not like, you know, you're not, it's not, you're not leaving them at the end of Empire Strikes Back where there's clearly more story, to continue with the Star Wars analogies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can have, you want to end it like Star Wars. You want to end it with like New Hope. Like this is okay. This tells a story. Boom, we're done. And do you want to see more? Cause there can be more. Then you can continue from that point. So I think that's, you know, maybe one of the better ways to dip in. And also, this is one of those ones that, you know, as indie publishers, we run into all the time is like new system teaching, learning a new mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. So many people are resistant to learning a new system. And I'm going to say this, if you play D&D and you're resistant to learning a new system because there's so much complexity to learning a new system, understand that at this day and age, you are playing one of the more complex systems that there are out there. There are a million indie and small price games that are much easier to learn than D&D. And speaking to the GM who's coming in, like, you're kind of on the hook to one of the things that will help a group to adopt a new game is if they don't all have to try to learn it in a vacuum individually. Mm-hmm. If you can come in having figured the game out, maybe even played in some other person's game, like just being a player wants to see it playing or watch some APs. We live in a world where you want to see a game run, you can check it out. So that you have a sense of what the game is and you can teach it, because there, I don't put a great deal of stock in the, I don't want to, it's so hard to learn a new system. It was hard to learn a new system in the 80s because nobody knew anything and you were all probably playing the game wrong because you had to learn it from the other person who like learned the game. Like there's so many ways to learn a new game system, and there are so many game systems that are cleaner and than whatever game it is you're playing, unless you're playing like an incredibly simple game, then you do have a leg to stand on.
I have a little comment on that, and then I have like two small pieces of advice. So first, I think if your game group or you are thinking, oh my gosh, it's so hard, it's such a pain to learn a new system, I think that's really telling on the pain in the ass that D&D is. It's a big pain in the ass to learn. You have to constantly reference the books all the time. It's very complicated. And you have to relearn it anyway if you're going to switch versions, if you're going to switch editions. Not everything is that hard, like Craig said. Maybe it's D&D's problem. Don't make D&D's problem my problem. But if you have a table that is resistant to trying these new things, or you have a table that you're trying to ease the other players into being GMs, so maybe you can have a little break. And this doubles as a quick cheat way to get you to get a break too, is you finish a campaign and you say, we are all going to pitch a game. We are going to pitch a game with the opening session or a one shot of your own campaign. Could be whatever system you want. And everyone's going to do it. So you have a table of five people. You play once a week. That's 5 weeks already before it comes back around to you. That's 5 weeks of a break, even if they decide to come back to the campaign. And the people who are going to be pitching these campaigns, they are very likely going to be invested in this campaign that maybe they have a game that they want to try. Maybe they have a campaign idea they want to try. They have a new genre twist they want to do. Or maybe you have a game designer in your group that really wants to like play test their new game. Right, everyone's going to take their turn. And if they do decide still, oh, it's going to be you again, because we like you as the GM, you've just had over a month long of a break. You're going to feel refreshed. You're going to have new ideas yourself. You're going to pitch your own new version. And if they like that, awesome. And you can run with it. If not, someone else carries on the torch. And maybe then too, you don't even need to reset the cycle after the next campaign is over, or the next, like, however long it ends up lasting. They might say like, okay, yeah, that was really fun. Now let's do Matt's game. I really like that one too.
Right.
But people are going to be more invested in it because they are going to also be putting their own energy into it. I guess that I said it was two pieces of advice, but it was really just the one.
I mean, I think this is, again, like just pulling from that experience that I have of having a game group. I mean, this is kind of like what you just said is like, you know, everybody pitch a game, right? I mean, it's like, that's, what do you want to play? What are you willing to do? It's like, mm-hmm. you can say like, that you don't like a game, or a thing didn't pan out for you or whatever, or you want to try something, right? It's like, great. Now you're in charge. You do it now. Like,
you said it. Yeah, no takesies, backsies.
Right. That sounds like a great idea. I would love for you to do that. I would love to play in that game. Why don't you run that game for me? You know, and that goes with changing systems, changing whatever, you know, it's like whoever has the most energy to do it, you know, like is the one who wins in some respects the next one to play, right? Like, because, you know, There's always games. There's a hundred. There's a million games. It's like a billion. What did you say? A million or a billion? It doesn't matter. Like either way, there's more games than you can play, right? And so it's who's willing to do it is the thing. And if anyone, that's your gift to the rest of your players, right? Your game group is all of you together. And so like your gift to the group is like, look, I got this. I've got. This is the game that I played a bunch, or this is a game I'm excited to run, or whatever. And you bring that energy, and then that people just will ride on your energy, you know, because it's hard. It is hard to do. There is, I don't know, there is, and this is sort of like you talked about what I think it was Craig. You said that like it's hard to learn new, it's not as hard to learn new rules if you're going from the crunchier to the not as crunchy. I did play with people that were like, but I already know these rules. I have to do zero work at all to learn something new, you know? And so, because they've already learned the old rule set or whatever. And so there's a comfort in staying in the same group, you know, in the same milieu, right? Because there's no learning at all. And I mean, if you're in a, this is ultimately why I had to leave that game group after years, is because like it was the demographic, you know, who was in the group and who was out of the group was always changing because it's people have lives and all that kind of stuff. But it got to the point where there was more people who wanted to play stuff that was more similar more of the time. And I was like, well, I'm glad you're having fun. You continue to do that. I am going on somewhere else. Because I want to play test all of these games by like my friends that are needing games to be play tested right now. And I want to try weird new games that I got off, you know, itch.io or whatever. And that, you know, the pressure of, but I don't want to learn new rules, you know, like that's, they're still meeting and they're still having fun, but I play test with other people now. So, it is that is, there's something there about like it the relaxation part of role playing. Some people don't want to learn anything new. They want to do the same thing over again because that is their fun, you know. And I guess that's just about the, again, about the table culture that you have. Like, what if you're all in agreement that you're going to do the same thing over and over again and you're all happy with that? There's nothing wrong with that, you know. But you know, I, you know, whatever. It doesn't have to be the big one. It can be PBTA. Like we're always going to play PBTA. And if somebody's like, I'm tired of PBTA, they're like, well, we all love it. And I'm like, well, okay, then I guess I'll find a different group, you know.
Yeah, walk away. If it's not fun, you should find something else. That can be a little harder to do. Like if this is your friend group and the only time you ever see them is when
Sure.
you're playing games. If you really like these people, do other things with them. Games are not the only thing, because if you base a friendship, like, oh, my entire friendship with this person is based off of pub trivia, and then the pub trivia stops, well, so does the friendship. Like, you got to base it on multiple things. Castle built on sand, et cetera, yada yada. Yeah, I think hopefully you have buy-in. Hopefully you have buy-in from people, and they're willing to try out new things. There are a lot of people out there who are just really resistant to change, and I get that. I understand. It's not me, but I understand. It's, you know, some people only want to watch like one certain type of show, or like they're only interested in playing a board game, like whatever it ends up being. But if, let's say, you have the magic, you got people who are willing to try something new, what do we do to ease them into this new campaign, especially if it's like a huge shift in tone or in genre or in system? Like, what are some strategies we could do if we're the new GM or the same GM, just new campaign? What do we do to switch it up? How what's the good tra What are our transition tips?
I mean, I think it's like, you know, session zero is really important, obviously, when you're kind of building characters together and setting tone. But like, I mean, there's all kinds of like preliminaries, right? So like you could do a session minus one and a session minus two and all the kinds of stuff of like you were
So
saying, like
hold on, I've never heard of a session minus one or minus two. I'm gonna be honest with you.
I'm just saying, like, what comes before session? If session zero is when you make your characters, who, so that you don't have to we all met in a tavern in session one, like what comes before session zero, you know, is just other layers of level setting, right? Where it's like what you're talking about. Like, we're going to have this session. We're going to talk about, everybody's going to bring their pitch. What games do we want to play? Great. We're in the mood for this kind of a game and this kind of a game. You don't want to use cards again. Great. Cause we just did cards with another game. Okay. So no card game rules. Like, okay. I think now we've got it down to like three systems and three people who are willing to run those systems and do these sorts of games. Great. This is what I'm saying is have a discussion, right? Get all your levels set as a group, right? About like the tone you're looking for, the complexity you're looking for, how long is it going to run? All of those are conversations. And that's what I mean. Like, all of these things happen before you even make your characters together on session zero, right? It's like, it's a whole series of negotiations about like expectations of what this is. And that's all part of the, like, the new system is going to be this. Okay, great. I have those dice. The new system is, I want to do a campaign that's like this with not too much. I want to do like a, I want it to be politically intrigue, but it's like an alien invasion, but your players aren't going to know that. So like, then it has to be like, you know, we're going to do a lot of skill rolls where we're talking and thinking and like doing mysteries. And then like, eventually we'll end of the sewers and we'll kill the, like, you know, hive brain or whatever that's taking over the city. But like, that's like session 10 and 11. We got to figure it all out first. And people are like, yes, I want to do that. Or people are like, no, I just watched a movie about that and I hated it and I don't want to do that. You know, like, that's, again, like just setting the agreement, the buy-in. These are things we've said a bunch of times, but like, it is, I think that would be my advice, is like, be open about, not necessarily like if you're trying to keep a secret plot line or whatever, you don't have to like reveal everything. But I'm a big believer in like separating the player knowledge from the character knowledge. Like, when the governor is taken over by the space brain, but you as players have to want, you know that that's what I'm doing. So you are setting up and playing into those tropes and playing into that mystery. And like, if you never go down to the sewers and meet the space brain, you're not fulfilling the obligation of the campaign you as players said you were doing, you know? So like, I don't know. It's like, it's all like level setting and having that conversation. And maybe that's hard to do if you're not used to doing that with your group, you know? So I don't know, try it out. Talk to people, talk to your players, talk to your fellow players about like those expectations.
Sorry, go ahead, Craig.
The thing that strikes me as something that you can do to prep for the new game is set aside, in your mind, set aside what games that are part of the world and everything, the campaign that was. But look at, if you've been playing with this group for a while, you know what kinds of things they like to see in the game. Do they like to see big rock'em sock'em combats that take multiple hours? Do they like to have mysteries that get, you know, like something's revealed out of nowhere and they get surprised and they have to deal with this complete game changer of a situation? Do they like, you know, heavy role play? We love to just go shopping with our characters and just have great role play and talk to interesting NPCs. And whatever those things are, and those can be group things and they can be individual things too, because certain players like, you know, like really love to latch on. I want to be like, Joe really likes to be the swashbuckler. He likes to come in and save the day and do something big and heroic at some point. We'll take
Byron will sneak off
and put that into this other game and make sure that like everybody has a big combat, or there's a surprise that comes out of nowhere, or that somebody the swashbuckler gets their moment, their heroic look at me moment. And you can do that in, you know, a lot of systems, and you can do that in a lot of genres.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. That's kind of like what I was saying about like knowing your players as a total group, right? And like, I've played with you for years, so I know that this is what you like. You're always going to play a sneaky character, and you're just trying to manipulate everyone into like letting you backstab them. And that is what you have fun as a player doing, and any system that you've got, you're going to turn him into an assassin because that's what you like to do. And so now that it's my turn to be the GM, I can't disallow that, or I know you're not having fun. So like, because that's because you've played together for years and you know that about the other person, you know, like it's, yeah. This is, it's like the rule for game masters, right? Of be a fan of the play or be a fan of the characters, right? It's like, that's when it's your turn to be the GM, you have to do that, you know? And so do it, give everybody their thing that they like, which is, you know, not, it's easy to say, harder to do, for sure.
I think pitching your game too. We talked about pitching your game, but like how to do that. Obviously, making sure that you're including those things occurs while you're playing the game. But when you're trying to get people like on board, like, hey, let me pique your interest. I think it helps to think like a game designer in a lot of ways. Like, how are you pitching this game? Like, who's the target audience here? Okay, what about this game group do I think would make them interested in this game? Like, oh, well, I've hopefully listened to these people and I hopefully know them a little bit. I know about their hobbies. I know about the media that they like to consume. Or I know, oh gosh, we were all talking about how we're so into Elden Ring and we won't shut up about it. And like, it makes it really hard for me to run this game because you guys won't stop talking about playing Elden Ring. Well, let's play an Elden Ring inspired game and maybe you'll shut up about Elden Ring for 2 seconds or something like that. So you can bring up those media touchstones, the target audience. You already have it. There they are. They're in front of you at this table.
Right. I mean, yeah, like the new season of whatever comes out, everybody's talking about it. And then like, but we got to play it. We got to play that game. Like there's file the serial numbers off of this system and add this in, and now it is that show, and let's just do that because that's what we're all talking about anyway, you know.
Give the back of the book blurb for the campaign if you're right. I mean, we're talking about switching campaigns, so let's talk about campaigns. Yeah. Give the back of the book blurb for your campaign. Stop right at the first plot hook if you want the mystery to happen, or if you're like Matt, like he said, you could say like, it will all culminate in doing this in the end if you don't mind spoiling surprises or letting the players kind of have a different direction of what they're going to end up doing. The tone, of course, is important, as we mentioned. And also what the system can do. If you're switching a system, it's so important to get them on board with why this system works the best for this game. Oh, we're going to play a gumshoe game because this is a detective game. And in gumshoe, like, we don't need to worry about whether our skills, our roles are going to let us find clues. We're going to get clues. We're going to piece them together. Or we're playing, yeah, we want to play this B horror movie idea. And we all kind of want to be involved, but we don't want to feel bad about killing off our characters. Let's try this game that I know called Die Laughing, where we'll all still be involved. We're just going to murder everyone as we go. We want to play a World War I inspired game that has paranormal elements, and check out this game. It has everything we need. It really increases the creep factor. It really has everything built in. It's like whatever it is, you should explain the connection, especially for people who might, you know, maybe they have been D&D loyalists for their entire lives and all they know is this epic fantasy and they try to jam all of their other genres into D&D. Explain like, what can this system do differently that this other system can't? Because there is no such thing as a one size fits all system. Like, you cannot easily play, as much as I've tried in my past, you cannot play a political intrigue story with D&D. It does not work. It does not work with the base game. That game is designed for epic fantasy combat and dungeon crawling. It is not there for roleplay, in my opinion. Come at me on the internet. No one will. Jeez. Everyone's always too afraid. I'll be the first to say it. D&D doesn't work for everything.
So but, yeah, go ahead, finish whatever.
I was just gonna keep saying silly stuff.
One thing that I think is riffing off of what you just said is something that I think might move us into our next topic, but the there's a, especially as a game designer, right? And so the game group that I've been describing this whole time definitely overlaps with the existence of Wet Ink Games. And so there's definitely stuff that got play tested in the group And, you know, they got to see it first. They got to they got to be upset by it first or whatever, you know, sometimes. And I think, or when you're playing, if you're playing, you know, the big ampersand game, or you're playing a PBTA game, or another 2D20 system game, you know, like that hook about like, okay, so it's the same basic system, but it's different in this way because this is, you know, Carter of Mars instead of Conan, you know, and that is part of your pitch, part of your hook is like, oh, well, we already know how to do this. Or, you know, the name of the system has escaped me, the one that you like, Craig, the Deadlands uses, right? It's D4 stuff. But then this has cards in this way because it's Deadlands, or, you know, whatever you add in the what's different. And that's sort of like what's different, right?
I see what you're doing.
I'm trying.
I see what you're doing. But I'm trying. Keep going.
No. I mean, that's the thing.
I see where you're going.
Like I've said, this is if you are a game designer and you're playing systems with people, like they're going to see your designs iterate. They're going to see your new things, especially if you've got whatever it is, right? You know, like this, we're going to do capers, but it has car chases in it. And so like, let's test out the car chases, you know, because I need to figure out if this works. And
you're talking about iterating a game design.
I am.
I mean, that's a brilliant way to test things out in a sneaky, subtle way as well. So you're not completely like everyone's kind of invested in this campaign. You want to figure out if this mechanic works. There's no harm in switching and adding that. I think that's a brilliant way to test things. Just like on the fly.
Right. I mean, this is a special, I mean, if you're a game designer and you're actually publishing stuff at any scale, right, and you have a game group and you're in charge of running it, you know, inevitably you're gonna like just be like, hey guys, this is something new, I'm trying, we're gonna test it out, that like you're my guinea pigs, have fun. And I think it's inevitable, like unless you just really have people who are like, no, we hate it, you know. But yeah, I think it's inevitable that you try that stuff out with your local, with your group. And then because you got to test it, like if you iterate on your system, it's something new. And then you got to try it out again, because you've unintentionally broken stuff that you don't even know about yet. And so you got to try it out again, even if it's the same system that you've used before.
I think the same applies for hacking other systems. I think that's why it's so important to try out a bunch of stuff as a game designer. All that GM advice is super useful for game designers, because it, you know, it's a vehicle for you to be well read in the industry. And then maybe like, oh, I really, really enjoy this mechanic. I like this system, but is where game design happens. Like,
yeah.
Oh, that's where you start hacking things. I mean, that's where a lot of people become little baby game designers, where they're like, oh, I hacked my D&D game and I really liked what I did instead. Okay. And I and I went off and I made my own thing. Like, that's where a lot of people start.
Yeah.
I mean, and as we've said before on the podcast, like GMs are often game designers in their own ways. Anytime you're homebrewing something, you're making up your own rules, like you're being a game designer. I think that it's when you're adding and you're adapting, that is creation. It's innovation. We did that a lot in like the campaign I was talking about, those campaigns, that gaming group. That was a game. The system we used was a system that was designed by our GM. And whenever we would switch to something new, we'd have a new version document based off of all the stuff that we didn't even know he was trying on us while we were going, but had like gotten our feedback from as things were working out by watching us, by paying attention to how we played. And I think that it just made the game richer that way. Brilliant game advice. Try new stuff out. And iterate on your system, like you said, iterate on your system to see what works for different genres, different groups of players, different types of campaigns, etc. Yeah.
I just happen to have like here at my feet a book that is one of the people that used to be in the game group that I was in. They are the person who told me about Powered by the Apocalypse, and they did a game called Lonely World, because it was like, wait, there was only like Apocalypse World and Dungeon World, and then they did Lonely World, and they're like, oh, it's this new thing, and yeah, the bakers are really cool. You just put this logo on the back of your book, and you can use the system. And I was like, what? But you know, and I've never played Apocalypse World, so I don't know what is different about Lonely World from Apocalypse World precisely, but like the whole thing with Lonely World is that like the world got destroyed by something. It could be zombies, or when we played it, we did fire is alive now, and so that is a bad situation for everybody, that the living flames are going to consume everything, so you've got to not have fire. You know, hot plates are fine, but not open flames. No open flames. Those are very dangerous, because they turn into monsters. And so
it's basically dorm room rules. No open flames, only hot plates.
Yeah. And I mean, we had a lot of fun playing it, and you know, he had designed it, and I think he'd like written the book, and I don't think we were play testing it. I think he wrote the game, and then he was like, hey guys, I wrote this game. I want to play it with you all. But it, you know, that laboratory, right, of like trying something new and iterating on it or whatever, because I like what you said, Jess, about the butt. It's like, I mean, whatever, like I said, I have not played Apocalypse World, so I don't know what separates the original from all of the variations. I've played several PBTA games at this point, though, and so this one but that butt was somewhere, right? It was like, what is it that he didn't like about Apocalypse World that he wanted to push in this direction and make this sort of more focus on? It's very survivor based. It's like mostly you're not fighting things. Mostly you're scavenging and surviving and having drama between the survivors and stuff like that, which is another trope of that genre for sure. But I don't know how that compares exactly to the original. Anyway, that's just, I don't know. I have no end to that statement. I often do that.
Me too.
the other thing that occurs to me, and I know like all of us being game designers, like I'm sure we do this, you know, we do bring it out. My company, Wedding Games, our big thing is that we kind of fell into this. We didn't necessarily start out intending it to be this way, but it is our flagship system is we call it Plus One, and it is, the dice are always the same. So the D6 dice pool mechanics have been the same in all five of the games that are part of the Plus One system now, but the cards are something different every time. And that's sort of like a selling point, we think, of the system. And so talking about iteration and stuff, it's like, we've created this work for ourselves that like, we can't do the same game more than once, because it's the shtick of the system that the cards are always doing something different. And we haven't run out of ideas yet, but it is answering the question of like, why or when is it time to iterate or whatever. It's like, well, we've set ourselves up that that's the way the game works. You know, the way the game line works is that the cards are going to be doing something different. So what is the different thing that feels thematic for this game? And we've done, you know, five games now that all work differently, as far as the card part goes. And that's been fun to, because one's a horror game and you discard cards and that's your sanity and sorry, you're going insane. And other cards are, you're a friendly dog and do you want to give them puppy dog eyes and convince them you're cute by playing hearts, or do you want to bite them with your diamonds? Like, that is a very different use of cards for a very different tone of game, and they still work because we iterated, right? That's the iteration. So
I mean, I did the same. Go ahead, finish your thought.
I don't know how to finish that. I've said the thing.
Same system, the same base system for Coven. For the Covenant of PS13 is the same base system for Means of Magic, is the same base system for two of our little micro games we did, 10 Paces, which is a Western shoot 'em up dueling game, and originating with My Mecha Has Shark Arms, which is a silly parody of mecha games. Like, it's all the same basic idea, where you're rolling a die up to a certain point, and when that hits, something happens. they're four incredibly different games, scopes, genres. Even like just some of them have GMs, some of them don't. Like, there's like so many different things you can do if you really like something, you can try new things out with them.
Right. It's like the opposite of what I did, where it's like we're doing a different thing every time, where you're using like anything that takes tension, which is most things that you're going to be doing in games, can use this tension mechanic of like, you know, the skillful application of smaller die types pushes you could get closer to your target, that kind, all that stuff that works with your system is it's the same, but applied in a different context versus actually changing it. But it's still a different game design. It's still that. Yeah, that's a different version of iteration. Right. Totally. I love it. Craig, have you ever iterated on something?
No, never. I'm in the middle of iterating a game system for the third time. Three games already exist. I'm working on a fourth. And I think you've all kind of hit on the core idea of what I've come to use as kind of the guideline for iterating on the game on an existing system, without actually specifically spelling it out. But I think it. What I'll say here is going to harken back to everything what you've said, is that it becomes a ship of Theseus question, like how much do you change the game before it's no longer that game? And I think having a strong delineation of what parts of the game can reasonably change, while keeping other parts of it consistent, so that people understand it. If they're playing one game, they go to the other one and it's like, oh, this works like that, but there's this thing and this thing here that are different. And I've done that with, you know, it started with Good Strong Hands, which was the system I call the Roll Track system, because I wanted to have a game where you are making, it's player facing, only players roll dice, and every time they roll, the roll means a bunch of different things. So it's going to be success versus failure. It's going to be degree of success that's built in there. And you're also, based on how you're rolling, marking on a track, you know, basically a series of check boxes. There's three tracks, and each of those tracks does different things. And so what happens is, across each of the games, the core system of rolling a dice pool versus target numbers doesn't change, but what those tracks do changes to a greater or lesser degree from one system to another. And those are always things that are kind of built to the genre and the theme of the game. In Good Strong Hands, if you roll really, really well, you're tempting the void, and the void is the thing that's trying to destroy the world. So it's going to corrupt you. So you actually, you succeed at a thing, you do really, really, really well, but then you get seated, you mark up on the shadow track. And if you fill that up, you gain a corruption power. And a corruption power is really awesome, and they do really cool things, but they're also a death spiral if you gain too many of them.
Like in real life.
Yeah. But then with Code Warriors, like in the previous two games, there was a mechanic, there was one of the tracks was like, it's just a currency. Like, you spend these points as you check these boxes, you can spend these points to do things like gaining an extra die on a roll or using a special ability. And then in Code Warriors, I had that track does that, but it's also currency, like literal monetary currency in the game. It's like how your character slowly amasses wealth from the computer system in Code Warriors, where you gain like this this unit of it's a unit of power, and it's a unit of money, because power is money and money is power. And when you get down to it, I don't say it as much in the game like that, but the game is all about classism and the breakdown of society when there is no order, and what you can do when you don't have rules anymore, what the world turns into. And I'm working on a version of the game right now that I've like, this has been a GM or a player facing system, no GM rolling. And my biggest iteration is the thing I'm working on now, where I'm trying to make, okay, well, what happens if the GM does roll? How does that change the system? It's still pools of dice versus target numbers. Mm-hmm. The tracks change. Does the GM have all three of those tracks? No, I think right now the plan is the GM has one track and can spend points from that one track to do the other things, but they cost more points. So the GM is a little more limited, so it still makes the tracks really cool for the players, because the GM isn't getting like too much. The players are getting the cool factor of the things that the tracks do. But then also, like, it becomes a question of like, well, now I've used to just be like, oh, you make a check and you have a target number and I can set a target number and it's pretty easy. But now, like, this, when you've got both sides rolling, now you start dealing with like, well, now, okay, what's your armor rating, and what's like, what, you know, like how does that get generated? You didn't have to have that in Good Strong Hands. You have characters that are walking around in armor that are holding a shield, but ultimately you're just making a body check to dodge an attack, because you're rolling. But in a game where there might be actual equipment, and the GM wants to be able to be like, I hit you despite your awesome armor, or whatever it is that you have that's protecting you, like you need to kind of build that into the game. So it's like making the game more complex, but I'm trying to keep at its core still this dice pool that will feel very, very familiar, and three tracks that will function appropriately to the genre of yeah. the game.
I mean, that is a challenge that mm-hmm. with the plus one that we ran into, like the original plus one game is Never Going Home, and we had the cards doing, it's the first one that before we knew we were going to use the system again, we were designing this game that had all of this value placed on the cards, so that the cards were your ability. You have to discard a card to do magic spells, and you can spend it to get the bonus in game. And then it has this narrative downside that you're discarding your own memories to do the thing, because that's fit to the horror setting. And it's also your level up. So you're trying to hold back cards to level up. And then it's all of this value is placed on these cards. So then we've never done one that was so complicated again with the one deck of cards. But then, you know, in Doggos, we wanted to keep the cards very simple. So like, it's not a tight economy of cards, like, cause it's the fun, friendly dog game. So like, you can spend cards willy nilly and do whatever you want, and then just draw new cards. And you know, there's no, and level up is not, it just, you completed an adventure. Great. You get more experience, just mark some adventure, cause it's friendly and stuff. So then, when we came to do Psychic Kids, we wanted it to be a little bit harder to do Psychic Kids than Doggos, but not as hard as Never Going Home.
And that's so killer. The middle ground is always a killer.
We were putting it in there. So like and I don't know that it was the right decision, but the decision that we made is that we kept like in Doggos, the cards do what the cards do, and they don't do anything else really. And in Psychic Kids, it's, you have to guess the next card on the top of the deck to activate your psychic power. And that seemed so cool and original from the original creator of the game that like, we wanted to not have any other narrative weight put on, a mechanical weight put on the cards to keep the drawing of the card and guessing the top card of the deck special. But then how do you level up? Because then we had to invent like energy points, and you're like marking your experience points, basically energy points. You can spend them to do stuff in game. Like, you know, that's a very common mechanic, but now we've introduced like, in theory, you should be keeping like a pile of tokens, or at least writing down on your sheet. Like, we put a box on the sheet where you can write down your current energy points, and then you turn in some energy points to level up and stuff like that. But it added this additional complexity that, you know, I don't know if it was the right choice, but it was what we decided. And then the raccoon game, the Garbage and Glory that we're working on now, like, we just made that energy point system a whole other separate deck of cards. So now there's two decks of cards, and they're each doing different things, and they have some overlapping things, but they have different things that they do. And so again, it's like, but then that's like an adventure hero game, so it feels appropriate that it's more complex again. You know, it's still probably not as complex as Never Going Home, but maybe it is because it's got two decks of cards. I don't know. It's it's like, but like, all of these choices are like led by something, right? It's like, okay, I've solved one problem with the last game, but now this version of it has to solve a different problem. So like, what can I learn from what I did before, and what do I need to change this time? And that sequence of things, from Doggos, making it so easy, No way. You just get experience. You don't have to track it. You just mark your levels up. Great. Then not wanting to do that, having to do the energy points. Now the energy points are a new deck of cards. So Garbage and Glory has two decks of cards, but it's called Garbage and Glory. So it makes sense that it has a garbage deck and a glory deck, and you're drawing from each for different reasons. You know, it kind of it fits the theme, right? But it's also like now we've made, I mean, this is beyond game design. This is into like owning a company and having to produce this. So now it's a box set of two decks of cards, and it's a whole other thing to produce, and that's a problem we made for ourselves. But it is, you know, I don't know. It's iteration. It is iterating on the theme, and like the next one that is getting designed is back to one deck of cards, and that's probably good. Like we don't need every one of them to have two decks of cards. That was fit for this theme, but not necessarily all the themes.
Let me
So.
tell you what my plans are after I'm done with the stuff that's already on my to-do list, because I have a million things I actually have to finish first. So I really liked Coven, really liked making it, really enjoy playing it. And I thought, there's other monsters, not just witches. So I'm gonna make one where you are not high school witches, you are sorority girl vampires deciding which frat boy to drain at night.
Nice.
And I'm gonna
Nice.
make one where you are workers in a hospital who are also, oh, so your daylighting is hospital workers, and you're moonlighting by creating a Frankenstein type monster in the morgue. In the
This is
and
good. This is good. I mean, you just do them all. Do them all. Keep them coming.
I want to do a werewolf one,
I
but
was gonna say,
for
where's the werewolf?
I want to do a werewolf one, and I want to do, I don't know. I'm very excited. Now
That'd
that's
be a tight
actual.
little game line if you had those four. Like those are four really
I
classic
know.
monsters.
I know. I'm really
You
like,
do the fish person, you know, what's
yeah,
the
the
like the
creature from the Black Lagoon type.
right.
Like, but I also wanted to do one where you're monster hunters as well. So you're hunting down a monster. Although I'm still going back and forth whether or not you guys are going to be werewolves or not. I don't know. Werewolves to me are solo. They don't hunt in packs. I don't know.
Wait, so the werewolf are the monster hunters?
No. I wanted to
Okay.
do you like you're working at a ski lodge in the 80s and you're also tracking down a monster that's hunting down the
I mean,
tourists.
I sounds great. Like
I
that's
know.
what's wrong with that? Just do that.
But I was thinking about would it be more fun if they were like at a ski lodge and they were also, I don't know,
Well, see,
werewolves? I don't know.
that's the ultimate iteration though. Well, yeah, right. That's like okay, so I've done five monster ones, and so this one's the hunter's one, and it's like
Right.
an appropriate flip of the script, I think, if that's the line that you're doing, you know.
Why
Yeah.
not both? Why not you start not as a werewolf because you can become a werewolf.
Honestly,
Are you willing to become the monster to take down the greater evil, the
no, that's
greater monster?
perfect because in Coven there's a backlash. Things happen if you exceed the magical limit of the day. You exceed your magical powers. That could definitely be the consequence of going beyond your abilities. You get turned. I like, thank you, Craig. Thank
And
you.
you could even go halfway to that because I've been watching The Boys recently. Season four just wrapped up, where you could have like a concoction that was created by some witches somewhere or whatever that turns you into a werewolf for these three nights of the full moon. So now you can go hunt the werewolf and defeat the werewolf, and then at the end you'll be fine, except there's a chance that you stay the monster.
I'm going to write this down after we're done with this call. Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with those. All because I liked, again, like I said, Coven had a very similar dice mechanic to several other things that I had already done. And I liked this theming and I had fun with it and I want to keep doing it. Iteration is
And
fun.
for the record, if you're keeping, because it the first two are, you know, like girls at a public school. The second one is girls at a sorority. If you're going to keep it themed to female, to women characters, it's easy enough to do with like just, you know, women med students at the hospital.
Right.
Maybe the werewolf one needs to be like the camp counselors
That's what I had considered camp
protecting,
counselors,
and that
but I
puts you in
love
the
the idea of
woods.
like 80s ski lodge. I just love
Okay,
that
just a
idea.
thought.
I'm thinking. I've considered these things.
They could be micro settings of each other.
Well, and I think this little mini game jam here. I'm playing my bingo card live on the episode, so I just got to mark game jam.
Oh, is that what you're doing?
Yes. So
playing the RPG R&D bingo card, because there are bingo cards.
What this thing about iteration is sort of like that, where it's like, and sometimes it can be a trap, right? Because it's like, okay, if I do the ski lodge thing, how do I fit it in? What else can I do? Because it's like, it's not quite a sunk cost fallacy, but it is approaching that direction where you're like, mm-hmm. okay, so I've already figured out how this system works. So I'm just going to iterate on it, because then I've got like 80% of my work done. But then like, oh, but it has to be tweaked and changed to fit the new theme or fit the new idea or fit in this new thing or to be used in this different way. And like, maybe you could have gotten there faster if you just designed a new game from scratch, but maybe not, you know, it's hard to know. But I think that's why you iterate, is because you're starting with something that you know, especially us all as game designers. It's like, I did this system. I did the work to make up the roll track system or the plus one system or the pace system. That's what you call it, right? The pace system. So like, I've got 100 other ideas that use the system I already came up with. I might as well just start there, you know? And I think it definitely feels like a shortcut at the beginning, and you probably is a shortcut. And then of course the marketing side of like, oh, it's part of the game line, you know, and then, you know, in 7 more years, you can put out the little mini box set that has all of the volumes of the, you know, the girl monster
with the crossover collection. Rules.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it is easier. But at the same time, like I feel like whether you're hacking a system that already exists or you're iterating on your own, I think that is also its own special challenge. It's like game design constraint. You have this constraint. You want to do it with this. And I feel like having that be the center, yes, it does make it easier to create. It's kind of giving you a shortcut. But it also puts that constraint on you in a way that can, like, having the limits can really amp you up as well. I guess it is easier that way to give you the boost of creativity too, but it's not, I want to say this for people who are hacking systems and things like that. It's not an easy way out to hack a system versus creating a new one from scratch. They have their own challenges. They have their own benefits. And they have their own marketing challenges and benefits as well. Especially if you're doing Powered by the Apocalypse. Now a lot of people hear that word and then they'd say, oh, I don't like those. And then we'll never touch them. Or vice versa. I only play this. I don't want to play your new thing. I don't care what you call it. But yeah, I just wanted to say that because I know we do have some listeners who do that. They hack games a lot.
Yeah.
Me.
Well, and you made a distinction between hacking a system that's already out there and iterating on your own system. That's not a distinction. Like, your system is now already out there.
Exactly.
Like, so it's the same. It's the same thing.
Exactly. Oh gosh, we've gone 20 minutes over our hour, but it's so easy to we talked a long time about campaign stuff. But let's get some final thoughts out here on the table about either of our topics, I guess. Matt, what are your final thoughts?
I mean, I think I'm just going to continue to say the thing that I always, I as somebody who used to only play games and now also makes games, I'm like, make some games, you know, like take, you know, whatever game you're playing, take out one piece, put in one different piece. Now you've designed a new game, make a game. Maybe it's better. Maybe, you know, you're going to add steam trains to your fantasy adventure game, make up some rules for that. Now you're a game designer. And I say it dismiss. It doesn't. I'm not saying it dismissively. Like, it may sound that way. I'm like, it really is that easy to quote unquote become a game designer. Like, just make up something, iterate on what already exists, and twist it a little bit to fit your custom thing that you want to do. And now you've designed something. And then if you get the bug for it, then you can design something else and something else and something else. But like it, the first step is can be a small step. It can be an iteration of a thing that already exists, and that'll lead you hopefully to bigger designs, more customized designs, more personal designs. But start small. I always say start small, start and start small. And so iterating on something that exists is the perfect way to do those two things.
Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show again.
I'm always pleasure. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Where can we find you and your stuff so we can play these games that you've been talking about? All of this stuff with these cool deck mechanics and plus one dice.
We have a website, wetinkgames.com. You can find links to them there, but those links will take you to Indie Press Revolution, where you can buy them physical, or you can go to DriveThruRPG to get them digitally, or print on demand there, whatever. I mean, however you want to get it, you can get it. We also are in distribution with a few places. So if you have a friendly local game store, they may have it already, or they may be able to get it from our distributors, or directly from us, you know. So we're out there, you can find us, but you can start with searching Wet Ink Games, most of the places that let you search, and it'll find us on YouTube there, find us on the internet, find us on Instagram, all the places. We're there talking about our stuff.
You can find me on the internet at wannabegames.com. You can find my stuff in the flesh now that Gen Con is over at the time of release, I believe. Oh God, I don't even know what time is. Probably. How many weeks? Until, it doesn't matter. You can find my stuff live in person at Goblin Market in Chicago if you are in a Chicago area. I was very happy about seeing all of my stuff on a nice little bookshelf nice. With a little local creator sticker. Loved that.
That's great.
And
nice.
Yes. And on the internet, usually Josca. Not always. Well. You have to work for it.
And you can find me at Nerdburger Craig on various social medias. My website is nerdburgergames.com. The store there has the fancy schmancy books that got like an offset print run. You can buy there. Those are the same cost as the print on demand, which is at DriveThruRPG, where you can find everything, digital and print on demand books there. Yeah, that's it. That's it for now.
Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Avil by Steph Sachs, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sachs. I see Matt is checking off one of his bingo cards right now. That's a free space. I say it every episode, baby. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you back here next time. Happy bingo. Bye.
That's a bingo.